cruising in our Galaxy-class Starship to another data center, we've hit a storage scaling issue. There's no way to add more performance to our antimatter storage array. The chief engineer suggests that we perform a Sauster separation to decouple capacity from performance, which will allow us to scale the two requirements individually. Hey, sounds snazzy. Release the docking latches, and let's hope this maneuver can save us. Welcome, everyone, to another fantastic show from the Datanauts collection of greatest hits, or at least that's what I'm going to call it today. Joining me, as always, my snazzy, let's see, we've used Mr., so I guess the Imperial Lord Ethan Banks. How you doing today, sir?
Imperial Lord, I like that. Do I get a cape with that title?
Don't you already have one?
I didn't know that I could. Now that I know, a cape is coming soon. Yeah, doing very well indeed.
Today, we're going to be talking all about decoupling storage. And if you heard one of our previous episodes, we talked about kind of general storage architecture, scoped out the landscape with Mark from Tagile. So today, we're actually talking with someone who's very much an expert in storage and VMFS and VVols and all of those other fun acronyms. We have Satyam Vagani from Pernix Data. How are you doing today, sir?
I'm pretty good. Thanks for having me, guys.
Oh, excellent. We're very happy to have you. I know you're the Lord of Storage Shenanigans as well. So I'm kind of looking forward to that.
15 years in the industry, and that's what I became, huh?
Shenanigans?
Yeah.
He's a funny guy. Real quick, though, I mean, not everyone, I assume most folks know you, but tell us a little bit about what you did at VMware and what you're doing today at Pernix Data.
Yeah, at VMware, I left the water running. They're still after me up for that. Oh, you mean the real deal? VMware was a great story in my life. I spent 10 years there. I joined way back when we were just getting started on ESX. You know, it was an experiment that we were trying to do, trying to figure out what happens if we actually get the host operating system out of the equation. You know, at that time, VMware used to run on top of a Windows or Linux install, and clearly those operating systems weren't optimized to run virtual machines. They were optimized to run much more lighter weight processes, things like Internet Explorer. Actually, hang on.
That would be a heavyweight process, yeah, right?
I'm conflicting myself. But things like Yahoo Messenger. No, hang on. Things like PowerPoint. No, hang on.
Well, man,
moving on. So that was how my career began. And back in the day, we were still trying to figure out what the storage strategy was for virtual machines. You know, what was a good substrate for virtual machines to run on from a data point of view. And so, you know, one thing led to another. I got the great privilege of working on VMFS. It led to VMware having a clustered file system, which it then leveraged for things like vMotion and snapshots and link clones and thin provisioning and whatnot. But anyway, 10 years later, I kind of started missing the good old days when we were much smaller. You know, we could make changes much more quickly. And so here we are. Now I work at Pernix Data. It's been 3 years since we founded this company. We are close to shipping our fifth major release. So lots of fun since then.
Absolutely. So educate us a little bit on what is decoupled storage, what is that architecture, and what drove you towards it?
Right. So some of this comes back from this virtualization context that both I and my co-founder Pujan had. And what we saw was, you know, the world was stuck in a very ironic storage cycle. Is for almost everyone, storage was a problem. And the problem actually revolved around getting performance out of storage. Every time somebody tried to solve that problem, they did it by rolling in more storage capacity. And so we found it very ironic that you start off with a performance problem and essentially end up procuring more gigabytes. And the reason you procure more gigabytes is obviously you want the IOPS part of those gigabytes, you know, whether it's some flash devices that you are procuring and putting inside your storage system or some spindles that you are adding to your storage system, which then you are going to short stroke just to get more IOPS.
Oh, you're bringing back memories with the short stroking. I do remember a big cabinet of hard drives. And for those that haven't used it, that's where you use the edge of the platter, correct? So you get the head doesn't have to move as much.
Exactly. Imagine that. We were actually very busy figuring out what's the difference between the edge of the platter and the, you know, the center of the platter. And I'm sure, you know, the world has more important problems to solve. So we figured, what if we can now that Flash is around, and now that Flash can actually be used on the server side as opposed to only inside storage systems, can we do something better? Can we make it such that we can deploy servers with some amount of Flash and then use it to solve the storage performance problem and let storage systems do what they do very well, which is storage capacity, just raw gigabytes and data services on top? So that's the genesis of decoupled storage. We wanted to rip out the storage performance problem out of storage systems, and we wanted to solve it in the server tier because we thought that is, number one, a more scale-out way of solving it, right? Every time you deploy a new server, you can deploy more IOPS. And it is also a more, in some sense of the word, futuristic way of solving it, is given the way storage media is evolving, especially flash-like media. You know, we are going from flash to PCI flash to NVMe and NVDIMMs and cross-point technology, something that Intel and Micron announced. So given how much media is advancing, we figured maybe we can leverage it in a much more fundamentally different way.
Satyam, what you're describing to me so far sounds like what I've heard from Nutanix and Simplivity and the hyperconverged guys, people that are taking storage, spreading it across all of the nodes that are in the hyperconverged cluster, if you will. How is decoupled storage different? I don't think I'm getting the nuance.
That's a good observation, Ethan. In fact, we are similar, but different. You know, we are similar in the sense that both hyperconverged systems and decoupled systems are about bringing scale-out performance, scale-out storage performance to your applications. And we do that by using the server-side media and aggregating them across servers. The place where we differ is that hyperconverged systems also bring in capacity, and we don't. Decoupled systems don't. And that was an explicit design choice. And the reason for that design choice was because we said scale-out performance is indeed the most critical problem to solve. And the ideal solution would be applicable regardless of whatever storage architecture you already have in your data center. So we wanted the solution to be much more universally applicable. And by not bringing in our own capacity, we believe that we can actually fit this scale-out performance tier in any existing data center.
So again, not your own capacity, meaning you're not putting flash, you're not putting spindle into the system. You're accelerating and adding performance no matter what storage is being used by a given system.
That's right. We are not taking the responsibility of managing your data at rest, right? And bringing you new data services, etc., which now you started off with a performance problem, but now you got to think about this storage system or evaluate this storage system in terms of, oh, is this doing the same type of snapshots that I'm used to, or is this going to do the same replication that I'm used to, et cetera, et cetera. We didn't want to bring all those considerations in because it kind of complicates. You start off solving one problem, and now all those other unrelated things, in my opinion, complicate the evaluation.
Okay. Let's take a moment. I'm going to walk to the virtual whiteboard and just make sure everyone's 100% on the same page with me as far as decoupled storage. So in my data center, I have compute nodes running a hypervisor, VMware vSphere, whatever, and I have a storage array somewhere else in the data center. And typically the VMs are provisioned and they're using storage that is provided elsewhere, somewhere in the data center. With decoupled storage, we're taking flash or memory or something that's high performance, inserting it into the hypervisor host. And then what does the I/O path look like? When the virtual machine is looking to read or write data to the storage array, when does that kind of acceleration layer come into play?
All right. So the I/O path, well, to put it in very technical terms, it looks very, very sweet.
Very sweet. Okay.
Yes, that's
that's a technical term. Okay, got it.
Surf's up.
At least, yeah, in California it is. Actually, it's more like, it looks sweet, dude. But
okay, so you have the sweet acceleration layer. I don't know, are you in reverse mode? Do we go less technical, which means more technical?
Yeah, you want me to explain it over PowerPoint? Is that what you want me to do now?
Maybe over SharePoint. That's
okay.
Even better.
Okay, no, that's exactly, that's even better. So right, so the way it works is we get into the hypervisor and we take control of the paths that are going out to your device, the paths in the sense of multipathing. This is done through a multipathing plugin that Pernix Data ships. And now for every incoming I/O that we get, and we also get the context of the I/O, so we know exactly which virtual machine is issuing this I/O. And so for each incoming I/O, we get to decide whether we want to service that I/O from the local server-side flash device or forward it to the SAN. If we have a copy on the local flash device, we will serve it from there. If we don't, we will forward it from the SAN. But when the SAN gives us the answer back, we are going to use that answer to make a copy on the local server flash device and then, you know, also forward it to the virtual machine. And so next time the virtual machine asks for the same I/O, we have it locally.
So you don't actually store anything on the SAN itself. You're a pass-through as far as that goes. But then you make the local copy once you've seen that chunk of data.
You got it, yes.
Would you consider that a cache? Or I mean, what do you call that? It seems like the name is important to me. I don't know why.
Well, we call it the acceleration layer. And the reason we don't call it a cache is because there are traditional definitions of a cache. And those traditional definitions actually describe a cache as imply the cache to be not clustered. And so one thing we did was we actually made a distributed cache, right? So we didn't want the two things to be confused. And maybe we'll get into why it is distributed later. But the second equally important reason why we don't call it a cache is, you know, caches are not fault tolerant. And it turns out when you are storing writes in this quote-unquote cache of ours, we also make it fault tolerant. So again, this goes way beyond the traditional notion of what a cache is, you know, like a buffer cache running in Linux or whatever else. Those are not fault tolerant. They are not distributed. And so we didn't want people to get the wrong impression. And so we used the term acceleration layer.
Fair enough. You've added some additional, I guess, value add to the quote-unquote cache terminology. So that's why it's important to me to understand the verbiage that the, you know, different organizations are using for these things. Now my head is thinking, all right, if I have some data that's potentially being written to the acceleration layer, then there's a period of time where it lives there and only there. So what about any kind of technology that's looking to grab data off a storage array that is now, I guess, kind of missing some of those blocks? How do you handle that piece?
Right. So, for example, maybe backup agents, etc., which are trying to do backups separately from the application, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, like a recover point deployment that's trying to replicate a LUN from site A to site B. You know, it's not going to have the freshest copy of those blocks.
Right. Multiple answers to your question is, you know, there are many technologies, like I think RecoverPoint is one of them, in fact. Zerto is another one. Veeam is a third one. These backup and DR technologies, they actually work at a much higher level, at the virtual machine level. And so it just so turns out that these technologies can actually read the freshest copy of the data, because when they issue the read or write, we will service it. And so because we are the intermediary anyway, both for the virtual machine, the original VM, and for this data service, so to speak, that is trying to leech data off, we get you the latest copy of the data regardless. Now, there are some technologies, like the ones that run inside disk arrays, you know, let's say hardware-based snapshotting or hardware-based replication, that will suffer partly from the problem you mentioned, right? Which is, you know, if you take a LUN snapshot on the disk array, then we are holding on to some of this data. There's two ways to solve it. Is one is we actually give you enough automation tools, you know, so we have Power CLI commands, et cetera, et cetera. And so as you are trying to instruct the disk array to take a LUN snapshot in that same kind of script, you can also ask FVP or this decoupled storage layer to destage all the data that it is holding on to the storage system. So automation is one answer. The other answer is, and of course this is subjective, but I see some of these hardware level technologies vanishing in favor of VM level technologies. So for example, in replication, we have seen that there's a move to software defined replication, right? As you know, people used to deploy hardware based replication, which used to cost quite a bit of money. You also need to replicate the same sort of hardware on your DR side.
Right.
Et cetera, et cetera.
Right, kill it off from the storage array, add those services up into the data center, bubble them up into the hypervisor.
Exactly.
Stop worrying about a LUN, start worrying about a VM or a vDisk, correct?
There you go. And so as soon as you start doing that, which I, again, you know, in my opinion, I think is a way of the future, per VM data services, then you have less of this concern because, you know, now those things are operating at a layer where we can definitely show them the newest copy of the data, regardless of where they are.
Yet another architecture clarifying question here that kind of popped in my head as we were talking through what the data flow looks like. Let's say I'm using a storage architecture already that is using my local disk. How does Pernix, in our example of decoupled storage here, fit into that? Because I'm already tied up the local disk doing something. Do I have to dedicate a local physical spindle for this system to work?
You got to dedicate a local flash device for this system to work. Or you can choose to use server-side memory. Everything that I talked about, the ability to, again, to use your term, cache data on behalf of applications, the ability to make it fault-tolerant, the ability to distribute all that data across a cluster of servers. We can do all of that with either server-side flash or with server-side RAM. We call it DFTM, distributed fault-tolerant memory. And in fact, maybe I'm going into a rat hole, but we are really excited about DFTM in that it started out just as a convenience factor. It started out exactly to answer the question you just posed, is that what if I don't have a flash device to dedicate to this whole decoupled storage business? You know, we said, well, okay, fine, we'll let you do memory. We'll allow you to use memory. And because we do all the fault tolerance, all the distribution and software, it doesn't really matter that memory is volatile and flash is non-volatile. We make inherently volatile medium, which is memory, have non-volatile properties by virtue of our software. And in fact, we are really proud of it because that is the essence of software-defined storage, right? Being able to impart properties on a piece of hardware that it is inherently incapable of having without that piece of software.
Yeah, that's fancy.
Yeah, no, it is SpongeBob fancy.
SpongeBob fancy.
Yeah. But then, you know, we did this, you know, we shipped it in FAP 2.0. But then we saw customers use it. And we actually realized that there was way more to this than we initially thought. We said, yeah, this is just a matter of convenience. But then at the end of the day, what you end up creating if you actually use a whole bunch of memory across servers and pull it through this decoupled storage architecture, you have essentially created an in-memory computing tier. And if you think about it, you know, many application vendors are now going this route. You know, people started off with Memcached in the big data world where it could pull in a whole bunch of memory across servers and just use it as disk because they figured going to disk was pretty expensive. And then people like SAP caught on and they actually shipped it as part of their products. So SAP ships HANA, which is their in-memory analytics system. Oracle ships a similar in-memory system with Oracle 12c. Microsoft SQL Server shipped it in 2014. All these vendors have started shipping in-memory capabilities inside their applications. And I imagine that there'll be more and more of these things because applications are getting to deal with an amount of data that just is infeasible to deal with any other way. But we are saying, well, why don't we apply the vMotion principles to solving this problem? So instead of having applications change, each of them changing one at a time to be in-memory computing capable, why not we just implement in-memory computing at the infrastructure level, where we can pull in a whole bunch of memory at the infrastructure level? The guy who is responsible for the infrastructure, which is the vSphere admin, gets to administer this as well. And the applications, don't worry, you know, you can bring in any application and now lo and behold, just like vMotion, any application can move from one server to another. Out here with DFTM implemented at the in-memory layer, you can have any application be in-memory computing capable instead of having to change one application at a time. So that's something that is ridiculously high up in terms of what excites me. And in fact, we wrote a paper recently about it and presented it at SysTor 2015 in Israel.
So Chris, as we review kind of the rollout discussion, what was decoupled storage or what is decoupled storage and how might you apply it? What stuck out in your mind?
I think it was good that we took a moment to talk around the differences between a cache and what Satyam's calling an acceleration layer. You know, the difference is subtle, but realistically, it's that there's a distributed fault-tolerant understanding around that data. It's not just a cache that you can throw away like tempdb or something like that. It's actual data. It hasn't been written down to the SAN yet. And so therefore, you have to protect that with one or two copies of the data across your compute nodes. Ethan, what are you thinking?
So decoupled storage for me was a brand new idea. This was something that I had not heard of before. And so for me, it was just getting my brain wrapped around the fundamental architecture. So we're intercepting storage calls from the hypervisor, which made immediate sense to me. You plumb up storage to your hypervisor, and then you can present storage however you want, and those specific links are abstracted away. So the decoupled storage sits down at that layer, looks for storage calls coming from the hypervisor, and then can decide, can I serve this up locally because I've got something sitting on flash, or do I need to go out to remote storage? And then if I have to go out to remote storage, ooh, I'm going to make a local copy of that so that I've got it the next time around. That all made good sense to me. And like you said, it is a lot like cache, but there is a subtle distinction there.
All right, I think I have a better understanding at kind of the high level of decoupling storage performance from capacity. And so now my data center nerdiness is peeking out a little bit. I want to understand what it takes to introduce this technology into the data center. With that, I'm thinking around the day one operations to install, configure it, and really just being able to leverage this technology. And I know a little earlier you talked about using memory, so maybe that doesn't have as much of a ramification around it, but Satyam, can you give us the high level? What does it take to get off those day one feet?
All right. So the typical story is it'll take you putting in some hardware in your servers. And thankfully, these pieces of hardware are getting incredibly easy to acquire and incredibly cheap as well, if I may say so. At this point in time, you know, an NVMe device costs anywhere close to $1.50 a gigabyte. And there are, of course, cheaper options available by way of SSDs. And so anyway, so one would bring in a device of a reasonable size. I've often been asked, well, what is the right size of flash device that one should put in, or what is the right size of memory one should add to a server to support this decoupled storage business? And, you know, the rough rule of the thumb is if you're using VDI VMs, you would roughly, you know, budget in approximately a gigabyte per VDI VM that you're using running on the server. And if you're doing mid-range databases, you would budget in approximately 30 gigabytes per database VM. If you're doing high-end databases, of course, you would need to budget in hundreds of gigabytes. And so now you know, you add it all up across all the virtual machines you have, and that's roughly the size of the flash device or the size of memory you get. But the great news is you can go wrong. This is not a storage system where a mistake is costly for the next 3 years. What you can do is you should ideally buy the most amount of memory that you can actually dedicate, throw in some VMs to be accelerated, and see what happens. You know, the great thing is server-side resources are so plentiful that more often than not, you would be just fine doing an approximate design as opposed to an exact design.
Well, that's what we all do in enterprise architecture anyways. You have all those fancy calculators and input devices, and at the end of the day, you kind of eyeball the server, you know, kind of half-lidded and say, yeah, this feels like a terabyte. Put it in there and just kind of hope for the best.
There you go.
Is there a bus constraint I would be concerned about where maybe I've got an option to put in 512 gig in a device, or I could put in two 256 gig, depending on what my architecture is. Is there a preferred solution there?
I would say no, Ethan. And the reason I say it is because of the contrast, right? As you know, our job is to make this system blow your mind vis-a-vis what you have. And what you have is a traditional storage system, which is doing milliseconds worth of latency. Even if you have an all-flash storage system, you know, it's going to take 800 microseconds just to serve that I/O off of that all-flash storage system because of the network latencies and the HPAs and this and that. So in comparison, you know, server-side memory and server-side flash is so fast that, you know, most of these design considerations don't come into the picture because we are in the storage domain, right? Not in the CPU domain.
And I imagine 3 or 6 gigabits a second is probably good enough for what you need, right?
Exactly. In fact, so much so that while we were creating FAP, you know, 1.0 and later, we found out a lot of operating systems, you know, literally software bottlenecks that limited performance, not hardware. So, you know, just to give you an example, back in the day when we were working on FPP 1.0, you know, we saw these latency spikes when we were trying to serve IO from a local server-side flash device. And this was a Fusion IO card, so we knew it could do less than 50 microseconds. But suddenly, you know, every now and then we would see latency spikes of the order of 700 microseconds, a millisecond. We were dumbstruck. And we finally root caused it to the way, in this case, the hypervisor completes IOs. And so it turns out if you get the timing of all the interrupt routines wrong, then it's just going to take you 354 microseconds just to complete the IO. And so that was very ironic, as you know, the flash device does less than 50 microseconds, and then just the software layer adds in 7 times the latency. And so there was a lot of optimization required to just get the operating system, the scheduler, the interrupt processing, all that stuff in order to kind of, you know, impedance match with the speed of flash and then later with the speed of RAM. But we are still in that era, right, where we are actually still trying to optimize the software stack to match the speed of all these new devices that are coming up. And so in this era, I would posit that, you know, these much, much lower level hardware optimizations are still not a P0. Eventually, of course, we'll get there. But right now, we are better served if we try to optimize some of the software stacks to work with these devices. Eventually, we'll start designing in these kind of very low-level details.
Yeah, especially if you're working in microseconds, like, oh, 300 microseconds, this software is running slow, you know?
Unfortunately, well, you know, that's our cost of doing business, right? As we did this UI, which shows a lot of, it's very transparent about what we are doing, you know, what kind of latencies we are providing to the virtual machine, what kind of latencies are coming out of flash, what kind of latencies are coming out of SAN. And so now, guess what? Because we provide that level of visibility, people are very, very curious to see if we are literally in the less than 1,000 microsecond range. And, you know, we got to live up to that expectation.
Well, that's actually a really good question. So, I mean, if day one we've got our installation done and things are configured and we're moving along and accelerating these storage operations, how do mm-hmm. I prove it and demonstrate that things are better?
That's a great point. In fact, it was one of my constant disappointments with the way we work as the enterprise IT industry, right? We deploy a few things and we just assume that they are going to work, and clearly they end up not working according to our expectations. So we actually put in a lot of effort into making all that data front and center, showing people what this layer can do. And more so because we are trying to prove not just the point that, look, Mr. End User, this is good for your data center, it solves your storage performance problem, but we were also trying to prove the bigger design point, right? Is why decoupled architecture versus just making your storage system run faster. And so if we could literally show you the nuts and bolts of what the decoupled layer can do for you versus what the storage system is doing for you, then hopefully you can wrap your mind around how to use this decoupled layer in the data center design. So anyway, long story short, the answer to your question is we put in a lot of effort in our UI, lots of data on a per VM basis as to what this acceleration layer is doing for you, and lots of data also on a per cluster basis. So, you know, what is the aggregate throughput we are driving? What is the aggregate latency we are driving? How the working set of the virtual machine is churning, right? So to help people understand applications, they should understand that, well, if this layer is not doing well, why? And maybe one of the answers is because we are not able to hold all the data in the cache that we want to hold for this application, and you've got to buy a bigger flash device, et cetera, et cetera. So we put in a lot of effort around that to show impact. The other thing we do, which is, I think, the most popular thing on Twitter, is we made this thing called a hero report, where we show people how much data they have prevented from ever going on the SAN, ever hitting the SAN.
Oh, yeah. I remember seeing people showing off their numbers, you know, the bazillions of IO that have not gone to the SAN.
Exactly.
So, well, again, ultimately, this does end up on the SAN, right?
Only the writes, but not the reads.
Okay.
Yeah. But yeah, you're right. The writes to end up on the sand. But even out there, you know, there is a point is that, you know, it is, if you look at, for example, an Equalogic, right, is it can do good batch processing. What it can not necessarily do is good interactive processing, right? If you're actually looking for hardcore, you know, very low latencies, well, not so much. But if you're just looking to drive 60 megabytes a second all the time, it does just fine, or even 100 megabytes a second. So that's the difference in terms of when we are able to serve the writes versus letting the storage system serve the writes, right? As you know, we can set up this constant pipe where we are flushing the writes. We might see higher latency when we are flushing the writes to the storage system, but it doesn't matter because the application doesn't see that latency.
Certainly. And that brings my mind to thoughts of scale. You know, we've talked about decoupling storage architectures, but how big is this meant to scale? You know, is this something I apply to a single cluster of my compute nodes? Is it multiple clusters? Does it just go like peanut butter across the whole data center? What's the intent of decoupled storage as far as the data center footprint is concerned?
The last thing, which is go like peanut butter across the data center.
Like the peanut butter.
Yeah. However, you know, as peanut butter has been known to, you know, you need to drink some water while.
Yeah, it gets you a little sticky every once
in a
while.
Yeah, exactly, right? So, you know, in reality, clearly, it's going to be in phases. But let me share you some empirical data, right, from the 2 years that we've been shipping FAP. It's one thing talking about it from a technologist point of view, saying, look, you know, I want it to be in every data center in the world. But from a data point of view, there are obviously the slightly more conservative folks, or for that matter, slightly more cost-conscious folks, right, as FAP is much cheaper than solving the same storage performance problem by throwing more hardware at the storage system. But yet, it is not free. And so people are going to take some time to deploy it as their budgets allow them to. And so it's going to be a journey. Along the journey, we found that there are very, very healthy proportion of folks who have already deployed it across their data center. So we actually see the promise of what we were out to do. We see it happening. We also realize that it is partly our responsibility to make it so, right? And the way you actually make a scale-out system successful is by making it look like a monolithic system in terms of management, right? As if you are going to make it such that the management cost of your scale-out system is the order of magnitude of the number of servers that runs that scale-out system, then you lost the battle. That is where monolithic systems win, right? I'm sure you guys have heard it from the hyperconverged guys too, is we pay a lot of attention to making this scale-out system from a, like, how do you upgrade this system? Well, you know, you throw it into WAM, press one button, and bam, you know, all your 128 servers that are running FAP are now upgraded.
Or you put it to a workflow and you have it automated, right?
Exactly, automation.
Maybe even not a person pulling the lever.
There you go. So all those things become really, really important. So these things that maybe are not as important for monolithic systems, those become really important. And so we've been paying a lot of attention to that to kind of make the end user's life easy in terms of using it at scale.
So I want to go back to your peanut butter analogy. We were suggesting that maybe someday it goes everywhere, but let's say I do have to pick and choose. I got a twofold question here. Are there specific applications that I should target where decoupled storage makes sense or I'm going to get a better benefit out of it? And kind of related to that, containers and Docker are really popular these days. Does Docker fit into this as well?
My investors have asked me to say yes. Otherwise, I get fired. But let me answer the last question first now, since I started answering it. Is, you know, yes and no. I mean, unfortunately, we haven't seen a lot of adoption in our existing customer base for Docker. I mean, clearly people are trying it out in the labs, but I'd be sorely mistaken to actually draw hardcore conclusions from that. So I'm afraid I don't have a great answer to your question.
Yeah, I mean, with Docker architecture, you just kind of removed another layer away from the hypervisor ultimately hosting that. So in theory, you can still intercept storage calls and do your acceleration, but...
Yeah, yeah. Right. So,
but those are meant to be kind of shorter lived, though, in my mind. It's not the SQL box that's going to be running for years, you know, constantly needs that performance. I mean, realistically, the idea is you'll launch a service, it kind of does its thing, and it goes away in a second, 2 seconds, in kind of the purest form. So maybe that doesn't even need the kind of performance that we're looking for. It's kind of a swarm anyways. Like Satyam said, though, it's probably less than 1% of the market's even really using it for production workloads.
Yeah, but you know what they say in the future, it's going to, you know, containers everywhere.
It's going to hockey puck, immediately containerize everything. So
exactly. but no, it's a very fair question. I mean, you know, I'd be remiss if I would, you know, we wouldn't look at that, right? I mean, that'd be a stupid thing to do. You know, at least we have our eye out to see what is a good, a killer application, right? To accelerate storage in the context of Docker. And if we were to come across that, then of course the answer is that yes, in fact, we can do that because it's a matter of porting FAP to that substrate, which is Linux-based, you know, very open APIs. In fact, it's easier to do than ESX. So we can do that. There's, of course, VMware's way of looking at the world, right? Which is run Docker in a VM, in which case the answer is yes, indeed, we would accelerate Docker exactly today. Absolutely no changes required. But in the pure native Docker world, mostly I'm kind of on the lookout for a good killer application, good set of use cases that we can chase after. And if we want to, then we port this to Linux.
Well, then let's steer the conversation back to the 99%. If I'm having to pick and choose where I'm going to apply this technology, are there specific applications, specific workloads where it makes more sense to use decoupled storage than not? Where am I going to see the biggest gains?
We do this customer survey where we end up asking our users where they are deploying this. And then, of course, every time we do a proof of concept, we get a reading of what kind of applications people are running on it. And what we see is the majority of people run databases on top of FAP, which makes us really proud because, you know, they tend to use this for the workloads that are actually very close to their hearts, you know, tier one workloads. So databases is number one. SharePoint, Exchange, general purpose IT, that is like number 2, 3, 4, that kind of thing. VDI is number 5 or 6. So essentially databases, SharePoint, Exchange, web apps, general purpose IT, VDI. That's roughly the top 6 workloads that we have seen with our customers. And database is the number one workload for us.
And is that because there's such a repeated blocks being accessed that you just get a lot of hits on what you've got sitting in memory or in flash?
You know, partly I would say that is one of the reasons. But I think, and this is my theory, by the way, another reason is if you actually think about databases, people don't have too many other options. You know, those things typically tend to be running on mission-critical storage systems like VMAX or something like that. And people are very hesitant to move the storage footprint of the database to a non-VMAX system. That is where we can very easily make a difference. As we are saying that, well, yeah, you don't need to throw away your very trustworthy storage system, but we'll get you scale-out performance in front of that storage system anyway. And so I think partly it's because of this option, you know, the decoupled architecture, letting them do that versus there not being any other options to do exactly that without breaking the quote-unquote VMAX constraint.
Yeah, the database administrator silo, if you will, is pretty sensitive to things like latency and being on that kind of shared infrastructure environment. I mean, some places that I was consulting with wouldn't even entertain the idea of virtualization because they didn't want to deal with that, you know, resource contention, noisy neighbor type issue. And fair enough, because when the database is slow, when I start getting, you know, queue full messages and things like that, trying to run a query, or they're very expensive, you feel it. You know, you definitely feel it very quickly when it's 10% longer than everybody's 10% longer. You know, it's not like just one particular app is feeling it. So I feel like a way that you can help bridge a silo between the vSphere administrator wants to virtualize it, the database administrator doesn't. Mm. Okay, what can we do from an architecture perspective to almost guarantee performance no matter what host your virtual machine is running on? This may be one way that you can help kind of extend the olive branch between silos.
No, absolutely. In fact, you just said it. I'll probably add one more thing in support of what you said is in a few cases, the virtualization administrators actually have been able to use FAP as a method to convince the DB admins to jump over, you know, finally try out virtualization, because they said, well, now using server-side resources, we can actually guarantee you something that you're looking for versus the earlier way where it all goes into the IO blender and what comes out is under nobody's control.
And nobody gets peanut butter on their face. Man, everything in life needs a hero sheet. I like the idea of saying, I put in decoupled storage, and here's the bona fide, you know, factual results of why it's awesome, what value is being provided, or even not value being provided. But that's a way that you can really kind of print it off or show it visually to your boss and say, look, here's the value, here's what I'm getting out of life. And if I remember correctly, they show things like the amount of bandwidth saved on the network, and I thought that might tickle your fancy, Ethan.
The hero sheet works for me as well. It's nice to be able to, in a realistic and technical way, demonstrate benefit. That ROI question is always the big one. And so if you've got a tool like that, it's pretty handy. And if you're keeping your storage off the network, that's always a good thing. Now, kind of related to that, one of the points I got from this was there's not a bus bottleneck that you're worried about when you're dealing with local flash storage. So I presented that question, should I put in one 512 gig flash or two 256s, assuming I had the space? And he said, it doesn't really matter because it's so much faster. You're dealing with milliseconds if you're going over the network to hit your array versus hundreds of microseconds if you're talking to your local flash. And therefore, it doesn't really matter if you got one or two disks that are doing the reads and writes from the decoupled storage layer.
And I love your comment, keep that storage off my network.
Satyam, let's look towards the future here a little bit. We've got a really interesting architecture, a tool that we can do a lot with to improve storage I.O. This kind of reminds me of something we talked about in show number 5, where we got into hybrid and all flash options for storage arrays. Do you think those approaches negate the need for a decoupled storage solution? Because in theory, the performance would already be there?
Mm-hmm. Well, hybrid, not so much. And the reason I say it is from experience. We've deployed a whole bunch in front of hybrid storage systems. The problem with hybrids is performance is not deterministic. The good days are really good, but unfortunately, you can't avoid the bad days. And so until there is determinism in storage, no problem is solved. But yeah, you have a great point vis-a-vis flash storage. I think that's a very good direction. Storage system ought to be all flash over time. Can I answer this question through an analogy? Let's say you had email, right? You had a Hotmail account way, way back. And then clearly there are 5 different companies working on making email better. And so then Gmail comes along and maybe, you know, Google Inbox comes along and so on. And you constantly, you know, jump from one email provider to another. But every now and then, a more exciting thing happens, right? Every now and then, a Slack comes along. And that actually makes you wonder whether maybe email, which was the primary way you were solving problems because that was the only known way to you, is the thing to focus on anymore, or should it become a secondary concern? So anyway, in my mind, the advancement in storage systems is like advancement in email. You know, it is a thing that does exactly what it used to do 10 years earlier, but now it is slightly faster and slightly cheaper. And of course, it should continue happening. But every now and then, we should also look at a radically different way of solving a particular problem, because only when we do that, we can potentially, again, in my very biased opinion, we can move the needle in a radical way, as opposed to moving the needle by 10%, 20%. And so, you know, in my mind, that is what decoupled architecture is all about, is instead of saying, will all flash storage system negate the need for decoupled storage? I wonder if we should ask the opposite question, is if we have decoupled storage, can we stop thinking about how much performance a storage system gives us? Yes, it may give us less performance, it may give us more performance, but it doesn't matter because that is not what you are going to look for in a storage system anymore. And so in other words, the storage vendors can look for a better problem to solve in making storage systems. Maybe they can make vWall storage systems. Maybe they can make storage systems that are scale out always. Maybe they can make storage system that can actually give you per application data services instead of, you know, per LAN data services or per NFS mount point data services, because that doesn't move anybody's needle. So
no, you'll never convince me NFS is going away. It's my baby. You get a gold star for the Slack versus email example because everyone hates email systems, hey, but
you know,
NFS is my boy.
Why don't you send me a Slack message with a gold star in it? That'd be really meta. But no, I'm not saying NFS is going away. I'm saying, you know, these storage systems, if you look at the last 10 years of innovation in storage system, it is performance driven. But what I'm saying is, well, maybe if we remove the performance problem and do it in a much better way through decoupled storage anyway. And the reason I'm saying a much better way is not because the guys implementing decoupled storage are more intelligent than the guys implementing storage system. I'm saying it because, you know, decoupled storage brings performance right next to the application. And so now we're not fighting the battle of physics. So now if we were to actually leave the storage performance problem out of the whole storage system conversation, my point is maybe we can actually focus on something more interesting instead of having the last 10 years of innovation, which to me, frankly, is the last decade of storage lost, by the way, not last. It's the lost decade of storage innovation, you know, because we are constantly focusing on storage performance, whereas we could have maybe made storage systems do something amazing, mind-blowing. So maybe we can actually spend the next decade doing that. The long answer to your question, but again, my feeling is, yes, storage systems will become faster, but maybe we should expect them to become something else, which we are actually not focusing on because we are constantly focusing on making storage systems faster.
Not just faster, but maybe smarter, or maybe, you know, giving us better metrics about what's going on within our companies, or is that kind of the direction you're heading as opposed to simply just raw numbers and throughput?
Exactly. Right. Like, in fact, Data Gravity would tell you exactly that because that's their main selling point. But yeah, you know, so we can imagine various interesting things that storage systems can do, which we haven't yet because we spend too much time trying to make them only a little faster.
Hmm.
And maybe we don't need to.
As much as I love NFS, obviously, just just fooling around on that one, I certainly agree that the protocol needs a little more work. Version 3 is long in the tooth. But kind of a final thought / question here. Something I've been tracking for a while is the VMware's project on the vSphere APIs for IO filtering, or VIO, not the laptop, the acronym. And that it's supposedly going to be put in as a big way for vendors like Pernix Data, it sounds like, to provide automation and control over hypervisor-based replication and backup and all those data services. Is that something that you are familiar with? Do you have an opinion on that? Just kind of for the future.
Yeah, no, definitely something I'm familiar with and looking forward to. As a first order of business, whenever VIO is released, we do want to look at some numbers because, you know, this API is going to be very, very performance critical. We are trying to make way for server-side vendors in an era where server-side media is getting really fast. And, you know, especially for people like us who do distributed fault-tolerant memory, we really need APIs which can kind of get us that class of performance, the same class as what we are using right now, being inside the hypervisor. So one thing I'm going to look forward to right now, I don't have an answer to that question, is, you know, does this API scale? Does this API perform? And of course, you know, the greatest litmus test would be if VMware themselves would kind of port the vSAN core to VIO, because that'll solve two problems. As one is, it'd be a great...
Gotta drink their own champagne, huh?
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, for the right reasons, right? As, you know, they could actually now definitely cement the great future of VIO, right? Because they can constantly make the keep the API alive. You know, my greatest worry as a partner is if VMware does an API, which then it kind of mothballs, right? Because it's not using it. And so my big question, honestly, is, you know, what is VMware's motivation? Keeping it alive, keeping it well-performant, et cetera, et cetera. Keeping it feature-rich, et cetera. And so if there was a big, good thing riding on it, which is vSAN, then clearly VMware would be really motivated to keep it alive and kind of, you know, in tune with the times. That's one thing I'm looking forward to is, you know, if VMware can actually try out some of its own projects using VIO. And of course, it'll kind of make the hypervisor simpler. Over the years, it has gotten really bloated. So this is a good way of getting some of those components out of the hypervisor.
Excellent. Well, we'll end on that note on the idea of a snazzy API to solve a somewhat bloated hypervisor from an API perspective. Sacha, really appreciate you being on. Can you plug where we can reach you on the interwebs?
First off, guys, thanks again for having me. You can reach me on the internet, maybe even continue this conversation. I'm on Twitter at Satyam Vagani. You could even catch me during VMworld, for example, at the Pernix Data booth.
Alrighty, that's it for today's show of the Datanauts podcast. You can reach Ethan. He's at EC Banks on Twitter or his stupendous blog, ethancbanks.com. And I'm Chris. I'm at Chris Wall on the Twitters, and my blog is wallnetwork.com. For more superb Datanauts content, go ahead, do the crab walk, head on over to packetbushers.net, and then you can partake on all that bountiful, delicious podcast goodness. It's got a fresh makeover, too. The site looks gorgeous. Until then, may your server lights blink, your storage spindles spin, and your cables be cleanly managed.
Yeah, no, I'll keep the expletives out. That's reserved only for Pernix Data employees.
Yeah, I think you'll have to move your mic again, though, because I can hear you breathing as well.
Oh, man. That's right. It picked up a lot of noises. Is this any better?
Yeah.
And this one's
okay at the moment.
Okay, we'll keep it here. I can't see through one of my eyes, but hey, you know, it's a podcast. So.
Thank you.